longer the pandemic persists, the longer that we have political unrest that's connected to it, I think the lower our opinion of science will be. I don't mean the three of us, our opinions. I mean just culturally and communally. I think that will free up room for folks like Alex Jones or Gwyneth Paltrow to hawk their wares. I think it will drive people towards more alternative medicines and to pseudoscience. And I think it'll be harder and harder to make scientific cases for facts. And that will have spillover effects on everything from public health to climate change to budgeting.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones, sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Welcome back to the Digital to Learn podcast. I'm Tiffany, and I'm here with my co-host, Brad Garner. Hi, Brad.
Hello.
And we have the opportunity to speak again with Brian Alexander. This is part two of Digital to Learn with Brian Alexander. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you. Greetings, everyone.
I think your observation about the pandemic and what is happening in higher ed, I believe this will be a turning point. I think there are going to be some cultural shifts in response to what people are almost being forced to do. How do you see the pandemic affecting higher ed?
Much depends on, first, how the pandemic itself plays out. So do we experience what the Hubei province in China experienced? Do we experience what Italy experienced? And that you have a sudden onset, the pandemic rises, it peaks, and then it recedes. And then you come out the other side and either it's gone. Wuhan didn't report any cases for a long time, or it's down to such a manageable level that we can compare it to other diseases that we already have public health care measures for. I mean, think, for example, of the seasonal flu, or think about AIDS. We don't have, these are all measures that we have public health steps for. But we don't close campuses for. We consider them manageable, if bad. So it's possible that we'll go through that, in which case, the other side of it, we resume higher education. And I think we will have a period of financial stress along the way in that public universities, again, about two-thirds of American higher ed, they get some money from state governments. So state governments are being hammered. Their expenses are shooting up and their revenues are plummeting. And we know across the country, red state, blue state, east, west, north, south, it doesn't matter. We know that the state governments are happy to cut public higher education before just about anything else. So publics will have problems. Also, the recession has hit. I mean, if this ends by, say, August, we nevertheless have a quarter or two of recession, which is going to make families want to spend less overall on higher education. Sure. And we may have as well backlash for online learning. There's a lot of dislike of online learning. People within and without the academy like to criticize it. It may be that enrollments takes a big hit, which again depresses revenue for almost every campus. If that's true, on the other side of that, and we have these institutions weathering a blow. Some of them might not survive. Some of them may merge. Some of them may just close. But then we have the academy going back to this. One positive thing, I suspect, I'm not sure, if we do have that kind of short plague cycle, we may have improved public perception of science because we may get more people thinking, medical science handled this pretty well. Mm. Now, if it's longer, and there's all kinds of reasons why the pandemic could last longer. We don't know what the next mutations will be. They may be worse. They may just be different and harder to handle. We have no vaccine. There's never been a vaccine for a coronavirus before. And we have no treatment. I mean, our treatment for COVID-19 is basically hospice care, i.e. we make someone comfortable until they either get better or they die. In that case, this could go on for some time, and we could imagine this lasting into 2021 or 2022, in which case higher education has had to mutate. We have some mix of in-person and online education. It may be alternating, so campuses move to block schedules, for example. It may be simultaneous in the high-flex pattern. It may be that we switch off semesters, or what I've called the toggle term idea. You know, campus starts face-to-face, an infection takes off, they send everybody home. And then they bring them back once that's all cleared up. And I think in that case, you know, we have all kinds of institutional change we have to think about. We have to think about governance. We have to think about the role of students. We also have to think about infrastructure. I mean, how do we maintain all this? And we can talk about the technology. I'm happy to do that. The third possibility is that we have waves of infection that come and go. We've already seen some possibilities of this in small areas. Parts of Texas, parts of Florida, for example, are experiencing a new uptake. And we can imagine other reasons for a second wave. There may be temperature as a cause. There's some theories that we may see winter driving an uptick in infections, as well as wounding and death. It's possible that we will see an infection from a country that has blown it. Brazil, for example, is experiencing this huge pandemic outbreak, and they've actually yesterday stopped publishing statistics on it. So you could imagine Brazil gifting us a new wave, gifting the world a whole new wave of COVID, just like China did with the break starting in Wuhan, in which case campuses then have to kind of switch back and forth, and they may end up being on a kind of perpetual emergency footing. Campuses invest in extensive testing, in extensive gear, constantly monitoring intelligence, constantly tracing and surveying students and the whole campus body. That's something we're not really primed for in the U.S., but we'll have to surface institutional practices for handling that.
Fascinating.
Thank you so much for sharing on that. And I just want to take a second to note that you have so many resources for educators on your website. I saw the lists in the blog post, so we'd love to direct our listeners to your site, and we'll have links for that on our social media and on our website, digitaltolearn.com.
Thank you.
Kind of want to transition now. There's two publications that I wanted to highlight. One is this month I saw is free and open for everybody, and that is your report on the future trends in technology and education that has been shared with our team as well. Do you want to touch on that first, and then I'll get to the book second?
Sure. The FTTE report is almost a decade old. It's a monthly trends analysis that looks at major trends reshaping higher education. We cover almost 100 trends. And they range everything from demographics, economics, labor markets, enrollments, to changes in technology, changes in educational technology. And a bunch of these are wrapped up into the question of a higher education bubble, or the possibility that we passed peak higher education. All of these trends are, in every report just mentions every trend and then backs them up with evidence. So every report tends to have between 80 and 120 footnotes. It's written for a very general audience, so there's no jargon. It's just very telegraphic, just point by point. Lets you track these trends as they develop over time. So I released this initially for free. We had thousands and thousands of readers. And then recognizing what an investment it took for me to create these, basically a part-time job, I switched it over to a subscription model. And we now have about 150 subscribers, including libraries, individuals, community college systems, and universities. And I've been publishing it that way ever since. But starting in April, once the pandemic really, really took off, I've also been sharing a free version focused on COVID-19 issues. So I published that to the open web so that everybody could have a try, because in this time of enormous physical, economic, and mental stress, I would be happy, very, very happy, if my work could help other people who wouldn't normally access it.
Mm. That's awesome. Thank you for doing that, too. It did look like a lot of work. I can say that there was probably 80 to 100 citations. So I'm sure that it took some time to put together, but we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Can you tell us, too, about your book publication from earlier this year?
Sure. My latest book is called Academia Next. It came out from Johns Hopkins University Press, published in January. It's a look at the future of higher education. And I'll tell you the structure of it, but then I'll tell you the thing that really scared people. The structure of half of it, the first half, looks at developments in the present. It looks at trends that point towards the future. So it's grounded in evidence. It's not speculation. It's looking at what we know. So it's kind of like the FTTE report on steroids. And the second half is a series of forecasts and scenarios depicting what the university could look like in the future. Everything from what happens to the university if we have a kind of retro anti-technology movement to what happens if we have a continued boom of creative uses of technology, to what happens if we continue sliding down from peak higher education in 2012 and we keep seeing enrollment tick down year by year, semester by semester. So that's the structure of the book, and it's been successful. A lot of people have been reading it, a lot of reviews, good conversation, which is what I really love. But what's creeped people out is the now notorious page 23.
Oh, no.
Any reader, just grab a copy, turn to page 23, just see what I mean. It's a part of a chapter where I'm inviting people to think about the future. And so, like we did earlier in this conversation, I was talking about different ways of thinking about trends and scenarios and so on. And I give people a few different thought experiments to imagine what the future could look like, make sure it was different. And 23, I say, so hypothetically, what would happen if a pandemic struck the world? A pandemic like roughly the size and scale of the Great 19, how would that change higher education? Would we move online? What would happen to sports? What would happen to the economy? And I wrote that in 2018, 2019. And since the book came out and since the pandemic hit, people have been saying to me, Brian, what did you know? What dark forces are you in league with? But
you truly are a futurist.
Exactly. This is one I wish hadn't come true. But this is not, the thing is, people compare the pandemic to a black swan. That is an extremely low probability but high impact event. And in this case, the pandemic was actually foreseen by a great number of people besides myself. In the futures community, we've been working on pandemics since the 1990s, really. And people have been publishing scenarios, they've been publishing forecasts, they've been holding games, role-playing exercises. You can find quite a few different ways people thought about this. In fact, I'd recommend everyone to look at the 2012 Steven Soderbergh movie, Contagion, which does a terrific job of imagining a much more dangerous pandemic than what we're experiencing now. So that book has gotten some attention and some fear, but also I think it's sparked conversations, which is what I really love doing.
Well, it certainly confirms your role as a futurist.
Great so.
So what's next from you in terms of publications? We know you're always active on your website, but is there something in the works?
Oh, yeah. I'm working on, I have a contract for my next book, which is tentatively titled Universities on Fire. And it looks for the next 75 years of higher education in the context of climate change. Trying to explore how everything in higher education can change, everything from the physical location of campuses to our curriculum to town-gown relations to academics as public intellectuals, and what it means to plan for a university if you're not just looking at September, but you're thinking about 2030, 2050, 2060, and you're doing long-term capital investment and planning, should your campus still be where it is? Or do you need to retool your campus, for example, to make green buildings, carbon neutral buildings? Do you ban carbon-based cars? Do you nudge your campus towards a vegan diet and so on? And there are all kinds of implications for this. I'm happy to talk about it. But that's the next big project.
So do you find that there are actually people on campuses across the country who are thinking about 2030, 2050, 2060? Or is it mostly next September?
Mostly it's next September, but that's typical of most of the world. I mean, we have a lot of incentives to think short term. The business world thinks in terms of quarters. So we've got that 3-month horizon that we tend to really focus on. academia has the semester or the term. And again, for people, we are just in many ways trained and rewarded to think more of the same. And it's hard for us to to poke out that way. I mean, that's why the field of science fiction is so important. And also always so controversial, always so challenged and dismissed. You know, science fiction, some of it asks, what will the future look like if something happens that's different? Mm. And that can be very challenging and upsetting. So even now, then we clearly live in a science fiction future. You know, I mean, we're talking across intelligent machines that are wirelessly connected and so on. Still, science fiction remains at times marginal. But that's, I think, one of the great ways to get into futures thinking is to consume science fiction. You know, stories, television, movies, games, there's a lot of it. And it really breaks you open to think about new ways that the world can behave.
Fascinating.
The purpose of the podcast was to connect faculty with best practices in digital teaching and learning. So my next question for you is, are there specific trends in digital teaching and learning that you feel that our faculty listeners should pay close attention to?
Yes. One of them, very immediately, is going to be the question of how we blend remote and face-to-face instruction. I don't mean that strategically at the level of a university or how many classes are offered. I mean within a classroom. Brian Beattie calls this high flex, where you have a physical classroom with students and or faculty and or support staff, plus remote instructors and or faculty, I'm sorry, students and or support staff. And that takes some lifting to be able to work. And it can be really powerful and very effective. But you need to have not just the proper hardware, software, and networking, but you have to have a different pedagogical framework, and students have to have different expectations. So that one is a huge one. A second is to figure out how to make online learning as effective as possible. I mentioned before that often it has a negative reputation, and people will really beat the drum about that. There are a lot of critics of online learning. So we have to keep improving our teaching. We have to keep fixing and innovating and trying new things out. And a good thing about this is we've been trying this for 40 years. There's a long body of research, you know, scholarly press materials, scholarly articles, interviews, podcasts. There's a lot of material on how to do this. Plus, we have experienced professionals who have been doing this for years, if not decades, instructional designers, instructional technologists, academic computing specialists, people in the library world. I mean, so there's a lot of resources, human and otherwise, that you can draw to do this. A third thing to think about is how to connect the pandemic to our teaching. And that is, for example, some call for a greater standard of care, that faculty have to take extra efforts to try to check in with students and make sure they're okay. They haven't lost friends or family. They haven't lost their jobs. That they're not suffering. And if they are suffering, if these things are happening, how to shape the class accordingly. And that does lead to strategic questions. You know, do you change grading, for example? But I think pedagogically, that's an extra step that we have to take right now.
So, Brian, would you be willing to make just one prediction for us today?
That we will have too much to talk about and we'll run over time?
Yeah.
I think one thing that I would like to put out there as a testable hypothesis is that the longer this goes on, that is, the longer the pandemic persists, the more the infections, the injuries, and the deaths pile up, the longer that we have political unrest that's connected to it, I think the lower our opinion of science will be. I don't mean the three of us, our opinions. I mean just culturally and communally. I think that will free up room for folks like Alex Jones or Gwyneth Paltrow to hawk their wares. I think it will drive people towards more alternative medicines and to pseudoscience. And I think it'll be harder and harder to make scientific cases for facts. And that will have spillover effects on everything from public health to climate change to budgeting. So that's a hypothesis. I mean, I'm basing this on history. I'm basing this on how humans historically tend to react to pandemics. Now we're in a different situation in some ways. It's a 21st century, not the 17th. But it is a pattern. So I'll just put that out there as a hypothesis. I think the shorter this goes, the quicker we get past this. If we have, for example, a combination of a great vaccine and great therapy, I think the opposite. I think Gwyneth Paltrow and Alex Jones will have a harder time selling stuff. I think people will be more willing to listen to scientists. So that's my tentative forecast for now.
You, sir, have been a fascinating guest.
Yes.
Given us lots to think about. So appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Well, you both have a knack for asking fantastic questions. Thank you both.
So that concludes our show for today. We'd like to thank you for tuning in to Digital to Learn with our amazing guest, Brian Alexander. Thanks, Brian.
Oh, seriously, thank you guys. This is a real pleasure.
Oh, good.
Please take care. Good. Keep up the good work, and I'll talk to you online.
Very good.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.